You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
Good morning. This is Pacifica's Letters and Politics. I'm Max Pringle, filling in for Mitch Jezerich, who's on vacation. Today, we'll tackle the GOP civil war in Washington with the nation's John Nichols, and then we'll take a look at Trump Care versus Obamacare with Kaiser Health News' Chad Terhune. All that coming up on Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. First, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Senate has voted to move ahead on debating the Republican budget plan. It calls for $5 trillion in spending cuts over the coming decade, including to Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act. The non-binding budget plan would permit Republicans to pass follow-up tax cuts later this year to benefit the wealthy and corporations. Speaking on the Senate floor, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said the Republican tax and budget proposals would exacerbate income inequality, where already trillions of dollars in wealth have been redistributed from middle and working class people to the wealthy.
This budget gives members of the Trump family a tax cut of up to $4 billion. But if you are a low-income pregnant woman, you and over a million other moms, new moms, babies, and toddlers may not be able to get the nutrition you need thanks to a $6.5 billion cut to the Women, Infants, and Children's, the so-called WIC program. In total, the Republican budget would cut more than $5 trillion from education, health care, affordable housing, child care, transportation, and other programs that working people desperately need over the next decade.
A final Senate vote on the Republican budget plan is expected Thursday or Friday. Donald Trump says the Pennsylvania congressman he chose to be the nation's drug czar is withdrawing from consideration for the job. Trump's announcement on Twitter follows reports that Republican Tom Marino played a key role and passing a bill that weakened the federal government's authority to stop companies from distributing opioids. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had said confirming Marino as the nation's drug czar would be like putting the wolf in charge of the hen house. A federal judge in Maryland heard arguments on the most recent Trump administration travel restrictions but did not rule from the bench. Federal District Judge Theodore Chong blocked a previous version of Trump's revised travel ban targeting six predominantly Muslim nations. Three lawsuits challenged the new ban. The Trump administration in September announced the most recent restrictions, which affect citizens of the mainly Muslim nations of Chad, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. The latest ban also targets North Korea and some Venezuelan government officials and their families. The ACLU's Omar Jadwat was one of the attorneys arguing the newest version remains a Muslim travel ban at its core.
This is still a ban that was ultimately decided on and implemented by the man who told us and has never recanted from saying that he wants to ban Muslims from the United States. And that's exactly what the ban does. There's nothing more clearly contrary to the Establishment Clause of the Constitution than saying that you can't come here because of your religion. And doing it in a slightly indirect way by saying we're identifying Muslim nations and banning people from those nations as a way to ban Muslims doesn't make it any better.
The Deputy Assistant Attorney General said the countries were selected after a month-long review and recommendations from the Departments of State and Homeland Security. However, he refused to provide any details about the contents of the report. The new ban is set to go into effect tomorrow. It wasn't immediately clear when the judge would rule. A federal judge in Hawaii is also weighing a motion to block the new ban. U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish forces have driven out the self-styled Islamic State group from the city of Raqqa. The city had served as the extremist group's self-proclaimed capital for more than 3 years. The SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces, were clearing out landmines and other explosives. Losing Raqqa is a huge blow for IS, which steadily has lost territory in Iraq and Syria, including Iraq's second-largest city of Mosul a few months ago. In this campaign, Raqqa suffered major devastation, leaving most of its buildings leveled and in ruins. Human rights groups reported that U.S. airstrikes killed more than 1,000 civilians in Raqqa. A wildfire is burning in Boulder Creek and the Santa Cruz Mountains of California this morning. It began last night as a house fire and at last count had burned 125 acres and forced evacuations. In Northern California's wine country, fire crews continue to make progress as residents affected by the fire are flocking to FEMA assistance centers. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good morning and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Max Pringle in for the vacationing Mitch Jezerich. Well, let's just say the Republican Party is having some issues. Tennessee Senator Bob Corker has warned of chaos in the Trump administration, and President Trump has been lashing out at the GOP-led Congress for failing to pass any of his legislative agenda. And former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon has been talking about war with the Republican establishment and threatening to run primary candidates to oppose incumbents in next year's midterm election. Joining us to make sense of all this is Nation Magazine Washington correspondent and political blogger John Nichols. John's most recent book is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Welcome to the program, John.
It's a pleasure to be with you. You do need a field guide to keep up with all this craziness.
We certainly do. Crazier by the second. I'll say before we take a dive on all of these critical issues, let's get your take on the latest brouhaha with President Trump's pick for drug czar, the Pennsylvania Congressman Tom Marino, who's bowing out of consideration for the job. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Journalism still exists. Pretty good news. We're in a moment where there are a lot of questions about how effective journalism is, whether traditional, what was once referred to as shoe leather journalism, where you actually go out and do some reporting and research and put some effort in, whether that can still have an impact. Well, you saw it writ large. On Sunday, you had 60 Minutes, Washington Post, reveal some information that certain people had clearly tried to hide about this congressman's active involvement in weakening laws and weakening regulations and altering structures in ways that the pharmaceutical companies like, but those who are concerned about opioid addiction were very concerned about. That revelation called into question the selection of this guy to be drug czar. And, you know, within hours, really, or days, short days, he's out. It's very good news. I don't see. First off, I think he should be out. That's a given. But second, I think we should really, put the flag up for journalism today and say, maybe we ought to do a little more of it. Seems to be working.
Definitely does. And it was an excellent series by the Washington Post and 60 Minutes. And we'll definitely be keeping an eye on all this as it unfolds. Now, are there any word on possible contenders or replacements for the job yet?
Yeah, there's internal people, from not just DEA, but also who've been active in some of these offices. And usually, I'm not saying for sure, but usually what Trump does in these circumstances is when he gets caught out appointing somebody who really is staggeringly scandal-plagued, he then defaults to somebody, to a safer pick, who's usually somebody with experience in the area, and I expect that's what you'll see. What I would suggest is, certainly the next pick, is we have to keep an eye on that, but more importantly, we have to keep an eye on the kind of broader crisis as regards Trump's response to the opioid crisis, and it is a crisis, and it's a really serious issue in states across this country. And there's two things that Trump is doing that are incredibly wrong-headed. It's not just him, but it's his appointees and his allies. First off, the repeated Republican attempts to undermine the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid have a real impact, because people who are struggling with opioid addiction, with challenges in this area, they need to have easy, immediate access to care and to therapy, to recovery. And if you're gutting out and undermining these programs, if you're calling them into question, if you're making it harder to sign up for them, as the Department of Health and Human Services has been doing, that is very harmful to the struggle, because it's very clear that, you know, there's a protocol here. There's a way to do this. If somebody comes looking for help, you need to get them that help very quickly. It needs to be accessible. It also, frankly, needs to be something they can afford. So, number one, that. Number two, Jeff Sessions has really reversed, or is attempting to reverse, a lot of progress we've made as regards the drug war. And, you know, there's an understanding that people need care, they need help, they don't necessarily need to be imprisoned. But Jeff Sessions is moving back toward that hardcore criminalization, that hardcore imprisonment model, and using the Department of Justice to send all the wrong signals. So as we think about this, let's think about the next pick for the drug czar position, but let's also be very conscious that what has been revealed and what we're starting to understand as we talk about this is a much deeper, much broader problem with where the Trump administration is going. And hopefully this moment won't just focus on personalities, but will also focus on changing some bad policies.
And we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that as it unfolds. Okay, John, let's get right into it here. What was up with that photo op in the White House Rose Garden yesterday with Trump and Senate Leader Mitch McConnell? It looked a little bit like Mitch McConnell was like the kid who was being dragged by his dad over to the neighbor after, you know, hitting the baseball through the window.
Yeah. I've done that. Did you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, so we know the experience. A little of that, but then it was also this other weird thing, because it turns out the kid has kind of control of all the money. You know, in the family. So you can't be too mean to the kid.
Exactly.
And so what you got from Donald Trump is sort of classic Trump, and this is a real part of the guy, which has to be understood. You know, it is said that he responds to the last person he talked to. That's not entirely true, because there's often, you know, members of his family and others who try to talk him out of doing some terrible things, and he doesn't do it. So, you know, or other aides and stuff like that. So it's not just that he's the last person that he talks to. It's that Trump is actually very much an undeveloped personality. And as a result, he doesn't have either the competence or the skills to, you know, confront people that he disagrees with and to develop nuanced relationships. So when he's standing next to Mitch McConnell, he's sort of, Mitch and I are getting along great. We have a wonderful relationship. I love most Republicans in the Senate. There's a couple we have some disagreements, but boy, you know, overall it's great. I'm going to talk to, you know, Steve Bannon and tell him to back off on some of these people. You know, it's this whole kind of conciliatory message, right?
Right.
And yet, you know, literally within a matter of hours, he was, in other comments, in a matter of minutes, he's backing Bannon up and say, boy, I sure understand where Steve Bannon is coming from. These folks are letting us down. And so you're getting conflicting messages, because I don't think Trump had it, you know, basically has the ability to stand next to, you know, somebody and say, well, aside from Hillary Clinton, I'll acknowledge that, or his Republican primary opponents. But he wasn't up to say, I've got some real differences with Mitch McConnell. We've tried to wrestle with some of them today. I think maybe we've found some common ground. We still have places where, you know, we're going to disagree, but, you know, we're going forward because we want to focus on some of these things. He's not capable of that sort of, you know, mid-level statement, so he goes all in. The other thing about the appearance with McConnell is, you know, what you saw here was the beginning of the demolition derby. The crash is coming. Because the fact of the matter is, if you think getting health care reform through the Senate for getting their version of health care reform through the Senate is hard. Wait till tax policy comes. Wrestling with tax policy is a nightmare scenario. It is very difficult. It takes presidents sometimes two terms to even begin to get focused on it and to begin to develop the coalitions, to begin to develop the trust. Why? Because tax policy breaks apart the corporate elites. It doesn't unite them. And as a result, when you change tax policy, say, on housing development or on you know, mortgages and things like that, you're going to have some people say, oh, that's a great idea, yeah, that's something we need to do for this reason, that reason. Then you're going to have other corporate interests come stepping up saying, hold it, that's how we make money. You can't change that. And so it blows apart coalitions. It alters how things work. It makes it very difficult to build, you know, a functional majority in the Senate. And I'm going to just tell you, I think they're going to fail. And I think that you're going to keep that tape of Trump saying nice things about McConnell, because I will tell you, in a relatively short order, I think you're going to have tape of Trump saying vicious things about McConnell. And I ultimately think that Trump probably is going to end up with Bannon supporting a genuine civil war within the Republican Party.
So we'll be keeping a close eye on our Twitter feed, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly where to watch.
Now, Trump, as you mentioned a little bit ago, Trump has been taking absolutely no responsibility for failing to get any legislation passed, and he's been in office 9 months. So what's your take? Is that just his personality? Or?
Yeah, it's totally his personality. And, I mean, I'm one of the people who, for what it's worth, cautions against, you know, just obsessing about Trump. I think we need to look at all the people around him, the people he's empowered. But the bottom line in Trump is quite clear. He does not choose to acknowledge failure or even difficulty. If things don't go right for him, somebody betrayed him. Somebody let him down. Somebody is either incompetent or evil. It's as simple as that. That's his view. And that somebody is never him. It's always somebody else. You've seen this throughout his business career, throughout his entertainment career, now throughout his relatively short political career. And that's just going to be the bottom line. He's always going to look for a scapegoat, for somebody to blame for his failures. And let's be clear, these are his failures. He has an incoherent approach to the legislative process. Savvy presidents, and that presidents could take many, many different forms. Some presidents, like Barack Obama, generally kind of are hands-off. They entrust people who are allies to go forward on some things, and they will back them up when the moment comes. But there really is, that's how, for instance, on the health care reform, when you did the Affordable Care Act initially, Obama put a lot of trust in members of the Senate to move that forward. I frankly would have preferred that he had a heavier hand on it, but that's his approach. Other presidents, you go back to somebody like a Lyndon Johnson, they're literally hovering over senators as the bills are being written. They're like poking and prodding and intimately involved in the process. That's another way to go at it. Trump does kind of, he finds a whole new way of doing this, which is he doesn't entrust people to do things. You don't know, there's no clarity on you know, who he is. He's dubbed and said, yeah, I want you to go forward on this. You have my imprimatur. I'm going to, as president, you're going to develop something. I'm going to support it. He doesn't. He can even change. You know, he's been working with somebody, and he'll change his position and reject things that he had a week before supported. But on the other side, he doesn't engage. He doesn't, you know, weave his way into the process and try and define it himself. So he doesn't trust other people, doesn't engage at anywhere near a sufficient level on his own. And result is, things don't go the way he wants. And from the sidelines, in many senses, he starts attacking everybody because he's not getting what he wants. It's almost the perfect recipe for legislative failure, and it's frankly why you've seen what's happened so far. Trump does not have a legislative record of accomplishment or anything akin to it. McConnell is failing on that regard. Paul Ryan is basically, you know, just sitting there, you know, bleary-eyed trying to figure things out. this is happening, I will counsel, Trump is becoming increasingly frustrated with the legislative process. Doesn't understand it, doesn't play it well, but also doesn't like it. And so more and more, he is looking toward his appointees, toward administrators he's put into positions of power, and also toward his executive orders as tools to get the policy changes he wants. Frankly, that's a really bad circumstance because it gives us a more imperial presidency. It empowers people who, frankly, have less accountability. And it cuts our elected representatives and the congressional process out of things, puts much more power over on those on Trump himself and on those who move based on his whims. So it isn't necessarily that we're heading in a good direction here. It's just that it's not heading in the legislative direction.
Now over the weekend we had Senator John McCain, who sort of has respect on both sides of the aisle. He talked about this half-baked nationalism while he was accepting the Liberty Medal in Philadelphia over the weekend. And he's been talking about a return to bipartisanship lately, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he certainly has. And, look, everybody's going to always have a love-hate relationship with John McCain, because it's important to understand, John McCain is an extremely right-wing senator. He is very, very conservative. There's simply no doubt of that. On 99% of issues, he is a guy who's way on the right. However, he's practical. I think some of his military background probably, trained that into him. His own personal experiences, I think, caused him to see things in maybe a slightly broader way. And it may even be that coming out of Arizona as something of an acolyte, or at least someone who respected Barry Goldwater, who was very, very conservative, but also often quite practical. McCain is, in many ways, a representation of an older conservatism, a conservatism of another era that recognized that sometimes it wasn't the most popular point of view, and so you had to work with other people, and also that process, literally how the Senate operates matters. So he has historically erred on the side of bipartisanship, not always. Sometimes he's been terrible on these issues, but, he's had at least an openness to it. And he's historically had an interest in reforms and process issues that do tend to get you closer, I think, to an honest debate, i.e., his support for campaign finance reform is an example of this. McCain thinks he can win in a race where the funding is relatively even, because he thinks he's a more appealing guy and he thinks his ideas are more appealing. Most conservatives don't think that way anymore. They think they know full well that what they're pitching is an incredibly unattractive agenda, and so they want to game the process as best they can. So that's where McCain is coming from, and that is something that is antithetical to Trump. Trump is clearly, kind of moving toward a place where McCain is his number one person to blame. He is the number one, kind of straw man that Trump is going to hold up as the source of all the problems. Fascinatingly enough, it's not McCain. The number one challenge and the toughest thing that's happened to Trump in this week is that Susan Collins has decided to stay in the Senate, because Susan Collins really is, much more consistently opposed to Trump on a variety of issues, much more likely to say no at critical points. And so it's just that I think Trump likes to spar with McCain, so he's focusing on McCain more. And McCain also enjoys the sparring to some extent, so they sort of tweak each other.
And by contrast, Mitch McConnell has been just trying to ram through legislation without bipartisan support and with a sort of a thin majority. Now, do you think this is the kind of a legislative approach that's ticked off the moderates, the McCains and Susan Collins?
Of course. No, look, Mitch McConnell has been, despite the fact that he and Trump are at odds with each other now and again, he's been Trump's, floor leader. He's been Trump's best ally. He forced the Senate to approve Trump appointees who should never have been near the offices that they've been given. I mean, Betsy DeVos disqualified herself in her testimony to the Senate, and yet she was approved, admittedly, with so narrowly that the vice president had to step into the process. Same with Scott Pruitt over at the EPA, Sessions at Justice. There's a bunch of these people who really should never have been approved. And I write a lot about that in the book. And McConnell made that happen. There's no question. That worked up to a point. You know, he could actually rally, you know, that Republican caucus and say, you know, well, let's stick together on this, on giving this president his appointees. He's very successful in the Gorsuch appointment process or nomination process. But now, increasingly, as you're moving toward issues that affect the states that these people represent and things that are very easily quantifiable, very, very clear on health care, on tax policy, on a host of other issues, you're hearing these aren't moderates. These are conservatives. Susan Collins is a conservative. But you're hearing these more mainstream conservatives say, you know, look, I'm just not going to go there because where you're proposing is influenced by Trump is something that A, isn't going to work, and B, is going to be very unpopular. That's what you saw happen on the health care. And frankly, on the tax policy, it's probably going to be even more of a mess because on the tax policy, you will actually see pretty egregious, pretty unpleasant conservatives, people that you they're much less likely to have any regard for than a John McCain or a Susan Collins, breaking with McConnell because the special interests that are rooted in their states, or frankly the special interests that have for a long period supported them and empowered them, are going to look at some element of tax policy and say, you can't vote for that. Even though McConnell's pitching it, you can't do that because that's going to harm us in this way. And remember, tax policy, as well as regulatory policy, is where Congress decides who's a winner and who's a loser. It's as simple as that. If a tax policy gives all sorts of, you know, benefits for mortgages and deductions for mortgages, for home ownership and other things, that policy is going to be very, very popular with home builders, with realtors, and with a lot of bankers, right? On the other hand, if the tax policy tightens up on mortgages, you know, reduces the deduction or even aims toward eliminating it, whoa, hold it. That's a tax policy that's going to be popular with some of the so-called deficit hawks. These are billionaires who, frankly, just want to reduce their taxes. It's as simple as that. They want to cut the size of government. They want to cut things down in a way that allows them to pay significantly lower taxes. Well, at the end of the day, you know, you're pitting some of these conservative Republicans between their billionaire campaign donors and their banker, home builder, realtor campaign donors. And I'll just tell you, that becomes a very messy process, and people line up in a lot of complex and weird ways. That's why this Trump tax plan, I cannot see how it goes forward.
Now, moving forward, do you think that this Steve Bannon threat to primary some of these GOP incumbents, do you think that he actually has any juice to make this happen, or is this bluster?
No, I think it's pretty real. Two things that are important to understand. One, Bannon is the smartest guy around Trump, by far. There's no question of that. He is a sharp strategist. He left the White House not because Trump forced him out. He left the White House because he's a strategist, and he saw a point where he was becoming a burden and where he thought he could do more as a kind of an inside-outside strategy with his close ally, Stephen Miller, remaining in the White House, literally writing the UN speech, writing many of the other key speeches, influencing Trump in all sorts of ways, and then Bannon on the outside, developing political strategies that push and prod Trump, but also support and sustain him in other ways. It's real. This relationship between Trump and Bannon is serious. It hasn't ended in any sense. People are very naive if they think that Bannon's somehow on the outs or somehow distant. As Trump indicated yesterday, it's kind of an ongoing process. He's talking to Bannon, and Bannon's talking to him. There's clearly communication there. How much, we don't know, but clearly Trump himself suggests that. And then final thing to understand, Bannon has money. Bannon isn't his personal money, but Bannon clearly has the very, very wealthy Mercer family, which gives at rates that are very competitive with the Koch brothers and others. And they're aligned with him. They seem to be supportive of the people that he supports, and they're not the only ones. There are others in this. There's a circle of very, very wealthy people who are sympathetic to Trump and or Bannon. And so the Bannon threat's real. It's just, at this point, it's very bombastic and very threatening because I think that Bannon is trying to influence a group of senators. It'll probably draw back to some extent. I don't know that you'll necessarily see strong, credible challenges to every Republican, except Ted Cruz, as he says. But I do think that there'll be some. And one of the stories, I guarantee you this, next year, we're going to be devoting immense amounts of attention to Republican primary fights and some of those generated by Bannon. Remember, Bannon already has a win. He's already claimed a win in the Mississippi fight. In the Alabama fight over the Luther Strange, Roy Moore primary.
How does the infighting and the lack of legislative success hurt the GOP and benefit the Democrats next year?
Well, that remains to be seen. We're in a very different political era than we've been in the past. People really are kind of tied into their parties, their ideologies, their camps. And so off-year elections, especially because turnout tends to be a little bit lower, off-year elections are really about mobilization of the base. It isn't about, you know, causing so-called swing voters to move from one side or to the other. It's, can you excite your base? Much of what Trump is doing, and I think often in alliance with Bannon, is to make sure that that base remains energized, impassioned. This is this whole, you know, fight over taking a knee, you know, the whole Trump assaults on the NFL and all this. This is purely political stuff. I mean, they're trying to energize the base in key states and keep it focused on some of these issues, similar with the Iran deal, similar with the North Korea stuff. I mean, Trump is, you know, he is messaging for political purposes, not necessarily for governing purposes. And I hope that's the case, especially as regards some of his bombastic statements as regards North Korea, which just make things worse. So you've got that scenario in play. That's a big deal, because if he energizes his base sufficiently and they come out and vote, and if for some reason Democrats are disenchanted or disappointed, the Republicans could still do much better than I think a lot of people believe. On the other hand, if the Democrats can mobilize a strong base of people who really do believe that Trump has to be stopped, and that even goes to talking about impeachment or at least talking about fully disempowering Trump, I think they can mobilize their base. So, you know what I mean? It's going to be that kind of battle. I think we're going to get a very, very good measure on all this fall when Virginia votes. There's a Virginia governor's race, and Ed Gillespie, the kind of mainstream, smarmy, lobbyist, conservative candidate, has really wedded himself to the Trump approach. I mean, he's definitely kind of gone Trump, gone Bannon with this race. Very tough on immigrants, really, you know, inappropriate, horrible statements as regards a host of issues, brutal, crude attacks and dishonest attacks on his opponent. If he succeeds, right, if he makes it through, then I think the Republicans will have locked in their template. And they're going to say, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to say to every Republican senator, even, you know, relatively more moderate conservatives, this is what you have to do. You have to run as a Trump candidate. If you're not willing to do that, you're going to get primary. If you are willing to do that, you know, well, here's the evidence, it can work. So I'd watch that Virginia race closely. I think that will define a lot of the strategies going forward.
And these first 9 months or so, we've seen numerous cabinet departures. We mm-hmm. just mentioned Bannon, and Tillerson has reportedly called Trump a moron. And can this party and this administration survive this kind of chaos going into the midterms?
It's a good question, and a very, very appropriate way to put it. Can they survive this chaos? We don't know. This is like a stress test, right? You know, we know that at a certain point, the stresses are sufficient to, you know, pull a party apart. And we've seen that actually happening in other countries. In Europe, traditional parties are either radically changing or just, you know, collapsing because of really the challenges of a modern economy, the challenges of a changing world, changing economy, and all the pressures that go with that. And parties that are not able to adjust. With the Republican Party, their adjustment occurred in 2016. That was to essentially go for either explicitly or at least accept a movement toward a right-wing populism. And there's no doubt of that. But it was always cynical. There's clearly people within the Republican Party who despise Trump, who believe, as Bob Corker does, that Trump is really dangerous. And where the stresses become sufficient, it could pull the party apart. And then thus it could be a very dysfunctional force. And you're right to tie it to the administration. If the administration starts to crumble, for lack of a better term, and really look like, you know, not just that Trump's a bad guy who you and I, other people, might disagree with, but that Trump is literally too incompetent to hold this thing together and as such a crisis unto himself, then you might see a group of Republicans stand up to him, really, which they have not done up to this point, and other Republicans defend him. Then they become so focused on that internal battle and really begin to look so incompetent, so self-absorbed, so dysfunctional, that they do create a circumstance where their base simply doesn't turn out to vote, where they're just like, oh, this is too ridiculous. And then Democrats do turn out, and it could be a tremendously good year for the Democrats. And that does root back to the administration. As long as Trump looks functional, as long as it looks like he's managing, not functional by my measure, but functional by the measure of the base, if they're satisfied, if they like what they're seeing, then the politics remains relatively competitive.
Before I wrap up with you here, I just wanted to get your take. Like, would a big legislative win, like just getting a budget passed this year, would that be necessary to sort of pull the fat out of the fire for them, or do you see that not happening at all?
I think the budget, which, by the way, there's very limited evidence that they're going to pull the budget stuff off. They might. It's within the realm. But there's a lot of Republicans in the Senate and in the House who are not comfortable with elements of this budget. And also, this budget's not a real document because it doesn't take in all the meddling and mangling and things they're seeking to do with health care and with tax policy. So the budget suddenly becomes sort of a footnote to all the other things. Or, if you want to give it more credit, it becomes a starting point for which you deal with a lot of other stuff. I don't think people, frankly, will be satisfied just by passing a budget. I don't think that they'll be that excited because budgets are passed on a regular basis. It's something that people know about, and I don't think that's the point at which people get satisfied. I think that for Trump, what he needs is a victory on something that is very quantifiable and very understandable. That means he either needs a genuine victory on health care, not the you know executive order stuff he's doing now, or he needs a victory on tax policy. I mean, one or the other of those things. I doubt that he's going to get that. So as regards the legislative side of things, I think there's going to be continued dissatisfaction, and that may well lead to a lot of internal party chaos and churn and primary challenges and other things. By the same token, I do counsel people, just because Trump is not succeeding at the legislative level, we should be very, very careful not to miss that in the departments, in the cabinet agencies, and also in the regulatory agencies, this agenda is moving forward. It's moving forward very rapidly. They're clearly doing tremendous damage to environmental protection. They're clearly doing tremendous damage to the delivery of health care services. They are clearly doing tremendous damage to our civil rights and civil liberties legacies in this country. And frankly, they are supercharging the military-industrial complex by putting so much emphasis on the generals and so much funding directed toward the Pentagon, while dramatically diminishing the diplomacy and foreign aid component of all this by really weakening and undermining, making, frankly, the State Department look ridiculous. And so one who's a critic of Trump might feel comforted by the fact that he's not achieving legislative ends, and that may have real political play out. At the same time, bad things are happening. They happen on a daily basis. Again, I read a lot about this in the book because I think that one of the dangers that we fall into is that we look so much at Trump's crazy tweets, we look so much at his difficult relationship with the Congress, and we look so much at the politics that we miss the day-to-day structural damage being done by his appointees and by all the people he's empowered.
And we're so glad to have John Nichols out there keeping an eye on all those important issues. John Nichols has been our guest today. He's the nation's D.C. correspondent and author most recently of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Total honor. Great, great discussion, as always.
Thank you. When we return after the break, we'll tackle the state of health care in the country with Chad Terhune of Kaiser Health News. I'm Max Pringle in for Mitch Jezerich. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Max Pringle in for the vacationing Mitch Jezerich. And joining us to talk about President Trump's health care policy this morning is Chad Terhune. He's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Good morning, Chad, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Chad, what would President Trump's recent health care executive order actually do in a nutshell?
Well, there's a lot that he's doing all at once. Most recently, and what people probably have heard the most about, is ending the cost-sharing subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. That was kind of the thunderbolt late Thursday and into Friday. And just so people understand, there's two big subsidies that were part of the Affordable Care Act. There's kind of a bigger one that helps people pay their base premiums. So we're not talking about that one. We're talking about this separate subsidy from the federal government that helps a lot of people with their co-pays and deductibles. So when you go to the doctor or those big deductibles, the money you have to pay out of pocket before your insurance kicks in, he halted those payments. And it's kind of a circular route. It's money that goes to insurance companies, and then they fund these lower co-pays and deductibles. And Trump had been threatening month to month to stop those payments. He called them a bailout to the insurance industry, which most agree they're not a bailout. They're just a pass-through to consumers to help them under the law. But he stopped those payments finally, followed through on his threats, and so that kind of sent everybody scrambling on Friday.
Now, there's been multiple attempts to do away with Obamacare. Now, you've been covering this for a while. Do you see this kind of thing happening anytime soon? Do they have their act together enough to do this?
I think you've seen that Trump has been very frustrated that he couldn't get a repeal and replace bill passed through Congress. We've seen, you know, numerous attempts over the last several months. So this, to me, was his plan B through executive action to kind of piece by piece try to unravel the Affordable Care Act. So, yes, it remains the law of the land. There will still be open enrollment in the exchanges November 1st. The Medicaid expansion remains in place. So the basic architecture of the ACA remains in place. But you do have Trump now kind of piece by piece, you know, pulling a thread here or there on some important funding. You have the Trump administration really slashing the advertising for open enrollment that's coming up. So through the executive branch, he is making some key decisions that could hurt enrollment, that could make premiums to go up. And then you kind of get into this other line that Trump often says, that Obamacare is imploding. It's a failure. And certainly Democrats and maybe supporters of the ACA saying, well, you're making that kind of a self-fulfilling issue. You are causing the premiums to go up. You are sabotaging the law, is what they would say.
The CBO has scored some of these recent GOP legislative bills. And what kind of effect would these plans actually have on moderate-income patients who rely on the ACA?
If you look at most of the GOP plans, there's kind of two different things. One, in the private insurance market, they try to usually relax the rules under the Affordable Care Act. So there's things like guaranteed coverage for pre-existing conditions. That's been very popular. That could go away. And many of these bills, they kind of give it an option to the state. So you could have certain blue states that would keep many of the rules. Maybe red states would relax those. Also, there's things called the essential health benefits. That was a new part of the law that said, look, every insurance policy needs to cover maternity care and mental health treatment and substance abuse and prescription drugs, because before you had policies that didn't necessarily cover all those. It was kind of buyer beware. They had a lot of gaps and holes, and this kind of set a new floor for insurance coverage that it needed to be comprehensive. So most of the bills have, under the guise of flexibility or state choice, said, well, you wouldn't have to follow perhaps all those rules, and health insurance is a trade-off. You can get lower premiums if the benefits are less expansive, not as comprehensive. And so Republicans have played that up. And another big thing for them has been to roll back the Medicaid expansion and even cut Medicaid funding over the next decade or so. That has been a priority for them because they would say, look, the program, the safety net program is unsustainable. We're spending too much money. We need to rein it back in.
And the CBO also showed that millions could get dropped from their plans, you know, upwards of 20 million and more. Are these the kind of people that would just end up in emergency rooms if they can't afford coverage when, you know, when they get sick or injured?
Yeah, certainly. I think the prediction CBO, many other experts who looked at those bills, that, yeah, you could have a serious rollback of the coverage expansion. Many people got insurance for the first time, most of them through the Medicaid expansion. And so, yes, if you start to do cutback to that, we maybe would return to where we were kind of pre-2014 when most of those expansions went into effect. And you're correct. That was kind of the problem before, that people still end up getting care, but instead of going to their primary care doctor, they might put things off, things get worse, then they land in the emergency room, and you and I, all of us who are on employer health insurance, end up picking up those charges, because if the hospital doesn't get paid, they're just going to pass it along to somebody else, and most of us still get our health insurance through work, and so our premiums go up. So it's kind of this cost shifting that just keeps all of us paying more and more.
Let's take a minute to talk about the opioid crisis. It's probably the number one health crisis that the country's facing. What kind of an effect would either the GOP legislative bills or President Trump's recent executive order have on payments that help people with their treatment?
Well, I think there's been a concern when they talk about cuts to Medicaid or to the essential health benefits, because both of those expanded coverage for people with substance abuse problems, battling opioids and other addictions. So I think the concern is if you rein in coverage, then people won't be able to get help when they're dealing with an addiction. They won't be able to maybe get into a residential treatment center. They may not be able to go see counselors. They may not be able to get medication-assisted therapy, which is often used now for opioids. So I think, you know, again, insurance coverage is key. If you can't get access to the doctor, if you can't get in to see somebody, because, you know, many people can't pay these bills on their own, particularly if you're dealing with an addiction, you're probably dealing with all sorts of other problems in your life, financial as well. You might have trouble keeping a job down. So I think the concern is if you roll back insurance coverage, you're not going to make it easy for people to get that treatment.
And what about Medicare, the coverage for seniors? Do these GOP plans have any effect on payouts there?
They've done less with Medicare. Most of the focus has been on the private insurance market and the exchanges, and certainly Medicaid has been a top priority. They have focused less on Medicare, and certainly that can be kind of a politically risky idea to go after Medicare. And certainly Republicans are a big fan of Medicare Advantage, which is kind of the private version of Medicare. They like that idea of private health plans competing alongside traditional Medicare. So I'd say for the most part, Medicare has been kind of left to the side.
Let's talk a little bit about prescription drug costs, which can be, you know, astronomical in some cases. What do you see happening there? How do you see that playing out with the GOP plan?
The drug prices have been a little interesting because you've had President Trump say things that, you know, many Democrats would cheer about, how drug makers were getting away with murder. He's talked several times about, you know, why are we paying the highest drug prices in the world? Why don't we get these lower prices that other countries pay? He's chided CEOs of drug makers, you know, for price gouging. So, you know, he said a lot of things that many liberals and Democrats would applaud. We haven't really seen any follow-through. We haven't seen any executive actions or anything precisely on that. But his rhetoric has certainly, I think, encouraged a lot of people who would like to see something done about drug pricing. There's obviously the idea of, why doesn't Medicare negotiate drug prices right now? That's forbidden under federal law. So I think that's kind of unclear what's going to happen. There continue to be hearings in Congress. You have both Democrats and Republicans are very frustrated with the drug makers and why we are paying so much. But so far, not a lot concrete has happened on that front.
Now, was the concept of like negotiating drug prices across state lines a big part of the GOP push?
Well, across state lines, usually what they're talking about is selling health insurance across state lines.
I see.
And again, that is allowed now under the Affordable Care Act, so most experts will say they don't see a big impact. And if you really think about it, healthcare is very local, so even if a health insurance company came into a state, they still have to form a network. They have to sign up the hospitals and doctors so they can sell a plan to you and I. So selling across state lines, I think, is kind of not seen as something that would really move the needle. Kind of lost in the past week, Trump did have the other executive order where he talked about association health plans. This is the idea of let small businesses and maybe even individuals kind of get together in bigger groups so they'd have more negotiating power. That has some elements of selling across state lines. And then he also maybe wants to relax the rules on short-term plans. So these are plans that people might buy for 3 months, 6 months, up to a year, kind of in between jobs. But again, right now, those don't comply with the Affordable Care Act, and people are afraid that would be an end run around the law and would peel off a lot of healthy people that you need in the pool so prices remain affordable. So I think that's the other concern, are short-term plans and this other idea Trump has for association health plans. Again, other ways to maybe unravel the Affordable Care Act.
I was dumping the employer and individual mandates. Could that have a big effect on the ACA?
The employer mandate, probably not so much. I mean, most large employers offer health benefits now. It's kind of just a competitive thing if you want the best employees, and people expect that. Among small employers, maybe only about half offer health insurance now. So, but many of them, the smallest ones, are exempt from that mandate. I think the individual mandate is a bigger deal because most people tell you you have to have that mandate in place, because if you're going to have guaranteed coverage, if I can show up sick, I have cancer, and a health insurer has to take me no matter what, you can't have an insurance pool of just sick people. You got to have healthy and sick to spread all those costs out, and that's why the individual mandate was put in there. That's why we have penalties through the IRS. If I don't buy health insurance, I have to pay a penalty through my taxes. So the mandate is key, and if you took that away, again, you get into this death spiral where the insurance market would just be people who have chronic illness, who are sick, and you don't have to be a great mathematician to know what's going to happen. Premiums are going to shoot up a lot. Now, I think there have been some Republicans who've had a different take on the individual mandate to say, yes, we need something, but maybe we do something like automatic enrollment. Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Republican, had that idea for all, where everyone by default would be enrolled if you weren't in an employer plan, and then maybe you could opt out and there'd be some penalty. So I think there's other ways to do an individual mandate. But right now, I think people agree you need to have something that would keep the healthy, give them an incentive to be in the market.
Now, the ACA has been more popular in some states than in others. For example, here, you know, in our home state of California, Covered California seems to be immensely popular. How solvent is Covered California, and could it withstand a loss of federal funding?
Well, Covered California has, and the entire state has embraced the Affordable Care Act, and certainly were one of the first to establish a state-based exchange so they could run their own. They certainly embraced the Medicaid expansion, which put a lot of federal money into the Medicaid program here. And yes, you've had huge expansions in coverage. The uninsured rate has been cut in half in California, which really, if you think about that, that was really a major difference to go from about 17% pre-ACA going into effect to about 7% now. And that is really a dramatic reduction in the uninsured rate. And you've kind of seen that across other states that have embraced the Affordable Care Act. Cover California has been fairly successful. Enrollment is about 1.4 million now. They have healthy reserves. Certainly Trump's action to stop paying those cost-sharing subsidies was a blow, and so Cover California kind of was anticipating that after all his threats. So they developed a workaround. So they basically told all their health plans, look, you need to add a surcharge, 12%, to your silver level plans, which is the most popular type of plan. So basically, we're going to raise the rates to compensate for this loss of federal funding, because insurers have to offer these lower copays and deductibles, and so they need some more money to compensate for that. So California's done a workaround to kind of soften the blow to consumers. Some consumers still would pay more. They wouldn't totally be insulated from that increase, because if you think about it, most people, 90% of people in Cover California, get a subsidy to help pay for their premium. So what's going to happen now is one subsidy is going to go down from the federal government. This other subsidy is going to go up. So the federal government actually will pay more money nationally and to California, just kind of which pot of money it's coming out of. So Cover California has done that workaround. And then also on the legal front, the Attorney General, 17 other states filed suit Friday. They're trying to block Trump's move. So you kind of have a workaround and kind of a legal maneuver trying to fight it.
I couldn't let you go, Chad, without talking about single payer. That's Senator Bernie Sanders' plan, which is a Canadian-style plan. And it's got a lot of backers, including State Senator our senator here from California, Kamala Harris. Does that have any legs? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating debate we're going to have the next 2 years or so. It'll come up in every election, state election, national election. And I've really been startled by how many, like, you know, Senate Democrats, fairly mainstream, have all been jumping on that idea. Certainly in Congress right now, it's not going on anywhere. Republican-controlled Congress, they're not going to touch single payer. I think at the state level, we're going to continue to have it. You know, could California go its own way with a single payer system? I think it's going to be incredibly difficult, but I think many in California are ready to kind of roll up their sleeves and have that debate. And then, you know, you could get into other variations of that. Do we have a Medicare public option? Do you let people buy into Medicare? Do you lower the age for Medicare? Do you kind of get the single payer kind of baby steps instead of in one big wholesale move? So I think that's going to be a fascinating debate to watch.
And as it plays out, we'll be checking back in with you, Chad. Chad Terhune was our guest this morning. He's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thank you.
And that does it for Letters in Politics today. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Abby Klinkenberg and Lucille Rousseau are our interns. Kirsten Thomas is at the controls. You can find our archive online at kpfa.org. That's kpfa.org. I'm Max Pringle, in for Mitch Jezerich, wishing you a good day. We'll be right back.
David K. Johnson is the New York Times reporter, a Pulitzer Prize winner, who wrote the recent biography, The Making of Donald Trump. He is now following that with the compelling, disquieting, What Donald Trump is Doing to You. Drawing on 30 years of closely studying his subject, Johnson promises to disclose Trump's actual impact on our lives. Hosted by Brian Edwards-Tiekert of KPFA's Discerning Upfront Show, Johnson will be here Thursday, October 19th, 7:30 p.m. at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing.